We know there's a lot that can go on during one night of baseball. Long home runs, epic pitching performances, catches that defy space, time, and gravity.
Climbing the wall, did he catch it? He did!
But what if you could get all of that summarized in a quick, concise, and at least we think, funny podcast that's under 10 minutes? Check out MLB.com's Morning Lineup. It runs Monday through Friday mornings on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you love listening most.
Neat or on the rocks? It's the Sports Bar with Danger and Battaglia on the Sports Leader, 95.7 FM and AM 950 The Fan, Rochester.
I don't pay attention to the favorite stuff or anything like that. I mean, starting Thursday morning, we're at even par, and it's up to me to go out there and play against a golf course and see what I can do.
There's Scottie Scheffler, best golfer in the world. Heading into the U.S. Open is the favorite. We welcome in Brian Koziel of Tee to Green in the Odyssey app and our Odyssey Sports sister station, WGR in Buffalo. We'll also talk a little bit of Sabres with Brian. The pride of SUNY Brockport. Brian, good seeing you on Saturday. Told you we'd make some time for you this week. Glad we could have you on to talk a little bit about the U.S. Open. I guess the question I have to start is, you taking Scottie Scheffler or you taking the field?
It was great to see you as well on Saturday. I think that we have reached the point where it is almost like it was with Tiger, where it is almost coin flip. I know if you look at odds, it's still plus money to take Scheffler versus the field, but man, it feels as close to 50-50 as we've had since we used to have this bet with Tiger, you know, back in the heyday when he was so great all the time. How could you not pick Scheffler to win? He's so locked in all the important categories, coming off of three wins in his last four events, trying to go for another major here. The conditions all set up for guys that can control their ball and control their distance, and I think he's doing it the best in the world. So it's so easy to pick him, and I know you're bringing me on to give all these insightful things, but Scottie Scheffler is just really good. I think he's better than anybody else. I'd pick him to win a landslide before I'd pick anybody else.
So I guess the follow-up to that, Brian, is knowing that Scottie is everybody's favorite to win this weekend, could we see Scheffler put on a performance a la Tiger Woods where he's winning by a lot, he's separating himself, and this is a statement tournament for him?
Well, could be, yes. The only reason I'll say, here's the argument against that, is that it's hard to rack up a lot of birdies at Oakmont. Now, could he finish at 1-under, 2-under, and then the next guy's at +7? I guess, yeah. But usually when you see these runaways, it's because also the leader is just on fire and, you know, maybe is making a ton of birdies. Most famous U.S. Open example of this, like you mentioned, Tiger in the 2000 Open at Pebble Beach when he was at -12, and then the next player was at +3, and he won by 15 in the greatest performance ever in a U.S. Open. Pebble Beach, though, lends itself more to scoreable holes. It's shorter. The rough wasn't as penalizing. The greens are smaller, so if you can hit them, the chances of you having a birdie putter are a little higher. Oakmont, this rough is insane. I'm sure for anybody that's been on social media or you've been watching maybe Golf Channel all this week, you've seen that the rough on average is going to be around 5 inches around the course. These greens in the renovation that they did in 2023 are expanded, so they're bigger size greens. So in some sense, they may hit more greens, but because of the speed of the greens, we may see more three putts, which can lend itself to obviously bogeys and maybe double bogeys and things like that. So I don't know if I would predict to say that if Scheffler's on his A game that he could win by, 10 or something like that. But I could see it where definitely maybe it's comfortable, kind of like it ended up at the PGA where he walked in to that last hole and ended up winning by 7. I could see, maybe a 4 or 5 shot lead here down the stretch where Scheffler just has to play it safe. I think what's maybe you could argue is fun or not fun about the U.S. Open is, it's the test of 72 holes of like grind and will. And are you going to have the wherewithal mentally and physically to be able to play all those holes at such a high capacity? There isn't holes where you can just like, well, if I make a mistake here, I'll catch up here. Even the par fives, there's only two of them. and they're both over 600 yards. One's 611, one's 632. So it's not even like, okay, at least there's a gettable birdie coming. Like, you're still, you have par fives with tougher fairways to hit. I don't think that if someone falls behind, I don't see any opportunities to maybe have that catch up. So it's going to be down to me just not getting yourself in trouble early. The classic line of, hey, you can't win it on these first 2 days, but you certainly can lose it. I think that applies for sure. I think if you get yourself in a hole, I think you're done. I really don't think there's scoreable holes that are going to be able to come up for this course. A lot of people label the hardest in the United States. And, you know, I was there for the last two Opens for certain days and watched it. And, you know, I know they've made it even harder. So I would agree with that sentiment that this is going to be a really, really tough challenge for the best in the world.
Yeah, Brian, to read that Rory McIlroy admitted to an 81 in a practice round, and again, it's practice. Maybe he was trying some things. Who knows? But what's happened here with Rory? Like, you win the Masters, and you're thinking, okay, this is going to be it. Your thoughts on Rory heading into this tournament?
Yeah, I'm kind of disappointed and surprised at Rory's mindset. I thought coming off the Masters win, especially judging just by the physical emotion and the words that he spoke after that win, of just how, like, freeing it was and how he's been carrying out this weight of the Grand Slam forever, and now he feels like, hey, I've accomplished everything I've set out to in golf. I've won all four majors. I got the Grand Slam. I'm a Ryder Cup hero. Like, he's done all of it. I thought literally, like, okay, he is going to play so free. He's going to play with a mindset where there's zero pressure. I thought it would really loosen him up. Instead, like, he seems almost agitated and annoyed. I know there was the driver non-conforming story that he didn't like, that his name was linked to it when other big names had the same thing happen to them. He hasn't hit the ball well off the tee at all. Part of his struggles at the PGA was that he was all over. Last week up in Toronto at the Canadian Open, he put on one of his worst driving displays that I've seen in years from him, and finished 150th and missed the cut, 9 over par. I mean, this week, if he is at all spraying it, he's toast. I mean, there's just no chance that at Oakmont, if you don't have good control or accuracy off the tee, that you have a chance. I mean, it's hard enough even if you hit fairways. It's such a tough, difficult challenge. So he was asked about his driver, I think, on yesterday in his press conference, and he's like that he wouldn't even, like, give information. He's like, well, it's a TaylorMade, because that's who pays him to play the driver. Oh, what kind is it? Oh, is it the same one? Or he wasn't, like, given any. He's like, oh, you'll have to come out and watch. You know, it's like, I don't know. Just to me, his mentality, I'm really, really surprised. I thought he would be as happy and, you know, on earth as any golfer could be. He's won three times. He's won the Players. He's got the Grand Slam. He got the Masters. Like, how could you be in a foul mood? And he just seems like he's in a mindset right now that he doesn't even look like he enjoys playing golf, which is something that is really puzzling to me.
The flip side of that coin, and we don't have to look back far, it was when Rory, in that final round of the Masters, was paired with Bryson DeChambeau, and we hear about, you know, how Rory didn't talk to DeChambeau, and DeChambeau, by all intents and purposes, has gone through, like, a complete image rehabilitation. I mean, DeChambeau was kind of like the heel of the PGA Tour for a while. He goes to live, and I don't think anybody bats an eye, but through social media and through some of the videos that he's posted and his actions on the course, talk to us about DeChambeau and this image rehab that he's gone through here over the course of the last few years.
Yeah, it's been a total 180. I mean, he was early on labeled as the mad scientist, kind of quirky. You know, what is this guy doing with all the same length clubs? People were really intrigued by it, and he was all about the numbers. Remember, he was floating his golf balls in water to see, like, which ones had different buoyancy levels and things like that to see which one would give him better performance. So yeah, very odd. Then he got into the I'm gonna bulk up stage and look like, you know, he's getting jacked up to go do WWE instead of the PGA Tour, and people were intrigued by the fact that he was hitting the ball a mile and as far as anybody ever had before. Then he goes to live, but he always kind of just seemed a little bit uncomfortable maybe with dealing with the public, dealing with fans, dealing with media. And that's definitely changed. I think maybe he probably had been advised to, like, hey, like, you should probably change how you interact with people, interact with the media, interact with golf fans that are a huge reason why you have this success and have this platform. And he's also, I think, probably matured in age. I mean, let's face it, when you're in your younger 20s, like, people obviously maybe mature as time goes on. So I want to give him some credit himself beyond the fact maybe if he's being advised or coached to do so. But now how he handles himself out on the golf course, even during matches, even during majors where he's out there high-fiving fans and tossing balls to kids. And even when an adult jumps in and grabs the ball, he chases them down, even though he's in the middle of a round. He's certainly changed his image. And I don't know how much of it's for show and how much of it's genuine, but at the very least, I will give him 100% credit for understanding that it's important when you have such a big role in golf. And now he is definitely, I would say, you know, top three in the world in terms of being a golf influencer right now. It's probably Scheffler, McIlroy, and him. In terms of the amount of influence that he can have on the game and have on youngsters. So I will credit him for understanding that the power he has and how he's really, really gone a long way to try to change that image. And he's become more popular that way too. Obviously, if you're not a LIV fan, people tend to not like the LIV golfers. But for me, DeChambeau, I've always said it from day one, even back before when he wasn't maybe as easygoing or as comfortable interacting with fans, he's always super, super interesting to watch. And now he can be a little bit more likable. So I love watching him, even if you're not rooting for him. I think he's as interesting as any golfer to watch.
We know there's a lot that can go on during one night of baseball. Long home runs, epic pitching performances, catches that defy space, time, and gravity.
Climbing the wall! Did he catch it? He did!
But what if you could get all of that summarized in a quick, concise, and at least we think, funny podcast that's under 10 minutes? Check out MLB.com's Morning Lineup. It runs Monday through Friday mornings on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you love listening most.
Brian Koziol, he hosts the Tee to Green. We'll also get his thoughts here in a little bit about the Sabres making a front office hire. Brian, of course, one thing that's kind of changed during the last few years, hey, we can actually get on our phones and kind of have a little action on this. And I'm looking at just your thoughts on it. Like, if we wanted to rather go the favorite, any long shots that have your eye? I'm going to throw one name, not a long shot, but the odds I'm looking at right now at plus 6,000 for Victor Hovland. Maybe I just feel kind of bad for the guy, seeing that he's come close a few times, and you know, certainly at Oak Hill, it was right there for him before Koepka won a couple of years ago in the PGA Championship.
I have been on the Victor Hovland train for 3 years, saying this is the year he's going to win a major. This is the year he's going to win a major. I just love his personality and super likable and always seemingly is having fun out there on the golf course. And I just love the fact that he's able to brush off a bad hole and still have that kind of happy-go-lucky attitude of like, hey, look at me. I'm getting paid millions and millions of dollars to play golf. So I think he's a guy to root for sure. Every interaction that I've heard from other members of the media that have interacted with Hovland all have positive things to say about him. He, of course, won the FedEx Cup playoffs 2 years ago, striping his irons as good as anybody. He was always known for maybe having a mediocre short game in terms of the PGA, comparing him to other PGA Tour players. He straightened that out when he won the FedEx Cup championship. But over the last year and a half, he's undergone caddy changes, swing changes, coaching changes, and I'm not quite sure if he's maybe got it where he wants them all lined up. He clearly has the talent that if he won a major, I wouldn't be shocked in any capacity. I've been touting him for years to win one, so I like that. Other names to throw out there. If you think putting is important at the U.S. Open, Sam Burns, who played last week well at the Canadian Open, obviously feeling good about his game, he's number one on tour in strokes game putting. That's a name that's maybe down about 20, 25 names. Here's a couple of other names that play hard golf courses really well that have performed pretty well in previous U.S. Open conditions. Russell Henley, he's a very, very accurate driver, top 15 driver in the world, driving accuracy off the tee. That could be a name. And Harris English, who also is excellent at putting. I think I saw a stat this week that inside 10 feet, he's number one in terms of putting from inside 10 feet. So, those would be a couple of names. I like Hovland, Henley, English, and maybe even Sepp Straka, who probably had on paper as good a year that he might be up near in the top 15 in terms of betting lines. He's number one in greens in regulation. That's an important stat to have because with this rough, you want to be putting at all times. You don't want to be chipping for your birdie putt or your par attempt. So Straka, who has won twice this year, he's had a good year as well. So I think if you're looking for like reasonable names without going like way down to the bottom of the list, I think those are a handful of names that people could look at this week.
Brian, if we're going to spend time talking about Bryson DeChambeau as we just did, I got to wonder what happened to his rival, because it feels like we haven't heard a lot from Brooks Koepka since he won at Oak Hill, and I'm curious as to what his game is like heading into this weekend's tournament.
Yeah, it hasn't been good. His majors, he's been struggling. I mean, missing the cut at the Masters, and he is a bull. Like that this is why he's done so well at U.S. Opens and PGA Championship setups, because they're harder. It's a grind. There's a lot of pressure. There's nothing really, enjoyable about playing these holes. They're grind. And Koepka thrives on that. And he's always said, he's like, look, these majors with pressure, and when they get tougher, he's like, half the guys, they can't handle it. He's like, I know I got half the field beat already. But lately, the last 2 years, I mean, basically since post-Oak Hill win, he hasn't been great. And I know that a lot of this has been that he hasn't liked his irons. He hasn't been really good with accuracy. I mean, geez, this week, if you don't have your accuracy game going, you're going to be in trouble. I would put Koepka more in the range of 50-50 to make the cut versus I would to actually talk about him being in contention this week.
I'm just looking at some of these pictures. Like, what are these bunkers here? The coffin bunkers, piano keys. Your thoughts on what makes this course Oakmont unique here, Brian?
So you mentioned the bunkers. Let's start there. 168 of them. Oh. It's one of the most that the players have ever seen professionally. I mean, if you take out the par threes, where obviously there's less distance, so there's less bunkers. If you just take them on at the fours and the five, that's double digits bunkers averaging per hole. So, I mean, that is a lot. Not only do you have to deal with them on the tee shots, but you have to deal with them around the greens. Yeah, the famous hole that they're going to show a lot if you watch the television coverage this week is in between the third and the fourth hole. They call them church pews because they kind of all line up like you would when you go into church. They actually added a 13th grass mound that they call a church pew this year because they wanted the hole, because they lengthened the hole and they wanted it to maybe be still in play for some of the longer hitters. So they've added a 13th.
Wow.
Originally, I was reading a story this week that they were all individual bunkers that eventually kind of morphed into one with these grass mounds in between. I guess a member in the 1930s saw that they had it similar at a course in New Jersey. And they thought, hey, we've got all these bunkers. Let's make it into one big one and kind of aesthetically make it a little bit nicer looking on the eyes. So that's in between the third and the fourth hole. That'll definitely be, I guess, people say, what's Oakmont's signature hole? It's probably hole number three with that famous, famous bunker. But, yeah, then you have these ditches. They renovated the course in 2023. They brought these ditches kind of back into play. These are more so what you see overseas, like, in the United Kingdom, kind of those style of courses. But old school links courses where they had these drainage ditches and these other courses that just filled in with grass, probably that's going to come in the most to play on the ninth hole this week. It's right in between the ninth and the first hole, but because the ninth hole is just scattered with bunkers on the right, players are going to be looking up the left side and there's a ditch right up the left. So I think the ninth hole is where you'll see those ditches coming into play more so than not. And they've also expanded the greens, which in some sense you'd say, oh, that makes that easier. But it allows for more different pin placements that can be challenging for players that the USGA, of course, loves. They want to have challenging pin placements. So that's something this week you may see this incredible massive green that jets in, it jets out, it circles around, all these sort of things. And then you're going to see the pin like stuck kind of like in a little peninsula area or something like that. So I think with the larger greens, you're going to get some really, really unique pin places that maybe you wouldn't see where we just have a course where, you just got kind of circular oval type greens where you just kind of stick it somewhere near the center.
And Brian, you mentioned the 600-yard par fives on the course. It was DeChambeau putting out a video on number 8, a 289-yard par 3, that if you get par for 4 straight rounds, I'd say you're feeling pretty good about yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah, these fives, there's only 2. And that's why I say, I don't think there's a lot of holes out there where you can even relax or feel like, okay, this one's gettable. Both par fives are over 600, 1611, 1632. So, I mean, most of these guys are not going to be reaching it in two unless they just hit the absolute perfect drive and the conditions are in their setup. So I'm sure Bryson will think about, hey, this is a spot maybe where I can gain on the field because of his length. You know, if McIlroy is able to find the fairway, maybe him too. But there are, I mean, even the par threes, we haven't even talked about the par threes yet. There's a par three that's 289 yards. If there's any wind against them, guys were hitting driver. I was watching a video where a marshal had said that during the practice round, he was there for 2 hours, and he said almost every single group that came through were hitting drivers. That's the eighth hole, 289. I mean, that's insane. My opinion, I don't love long par threes. I think we've probably discussed this before at some point over the years. The best par threes in the world are short ones. The pair at Augusta on the back nine, 12 and 16. Number seven at Pebble Beach is just 100 yards. The postage stamp at Royal Troon's like 120. The Island Green at Sawgrass is like a pitching wedge for the pros. It's like 135, 140. I don't really know of anybody that says, hey, this is an amazing par three, that says it because it's long. And, you know, 289, all right, it's the USGA kind of flexing their muscles. But when all the other par threes are long too, like, I don't love it. To me, sometimes the best par threes are the ones that are short, and it's with a crazy pin placement with a lot of danger around it. And if you hit it, great. You got an awesome chance at a birdie. Like, that's what I'm looking for in par threes. I don't need it to be 289.
Brian, we got to ask you about the Sabres as, boy, they had a hiring. Jarmo Kekalainen, it feels like he's the GM in waiting. Tell me what Kevin Adams has to do here to keep his job long term.
I think the pressure is really on Kevin Adams. I think he's super lucky to be fortunate enough that he has an owner that is really standing loyal and standing to kind of beside him and giving him a sixth season. The NHL changes coaches and GMs as much as any in pro, you know, the big four major sports. They fire coaches and GMs mid-season when they're in a playoff spot. Look at Peter DeVore, just got fired from Dallas for making the conference finals. I mean, that is ridiculous. The NBA, the Denver Nuggets made the conference finals. They changed coaches. Like, this is what happens in pro sports. And the GM here is going on season six, where in his five previous, they missed the playoffs in a league where half the teams make the playoffs. And in two of those five, they finished dead last and got the number one overall pick. I mean, it is not a resume to say that you should come back for season six. I think Kevin Adams is super fortunate. Now, to answer your question, yes, to have Kekalainen come in here and then all of a sudden have this GM experience, have an impressive resume from Columbus, I think the pressure is on. I think if they get off to a bad start and it's mid-November and they're sitting there at, like, you know, 6-12-3 and they're sitting third last in the East, I think Adams is done. I really do. I think this offseason is super important for him to have to do something. I know national reporters have said, like, oh, the Sabres seem to be busy. Here's what Adams has in terms of a card to play. He's got prospects. He's got draft picks. He has to use them. There's no reason to save them. He may not see these prospects hit the NHL ice. He may not be here to use those draft picks. He has to win now, and he's even got to win, I think, early in the season. I think if they get off to a bad start, I think he's done. I know Terry Pegula probably cannot stand to swallow paying for another GM or another coach that's not working for him, but you've got a guy in waiting. It's not even like you have to go out and interview. You have a guy with GM experience who's done a good job and signed free agents and has a proven track record from Columbus that now is sitting in your office. So it's an easy move to make at any point. You're paying them both anyway. So if I'm Kevin Adams and, you know, free agency and trades coming up this offseason, it has to be all about winning now and winning in the first half of the year. I think if they get off to another bad start, I think Adams is out.
Brian, you mentioned some of the prospects and chips that the Sabres might have to play with here in the offseason. Is J.J. Paterka one of those chips? How confident are you that he is going to be a Buffalo Sabre moving forward?
I think I'd say slightly confident. I think they really, really like Paterka. I think one of the things the Sabres do well is score. That's one area that I would say they don't have to necessarily spend hours and hours and hours worrying about. Out of all the things on their team that they have to worry about, I think scoring is at least semi down the list. But a big reason is because they have a guy like Paterka who still has a lot of upside. You're going to have to pay him at some point if you want to keep him long term. But he's just got natural scoring ability. He seems like he can handle pressure moments. He's scored on the power play when they've needed to. And he seems to be well-liked. Now, I know last year there was kind of this fan contingent to say, look, he doesn't look happy ever when he's out of the ice. He doesn't even acknowledge when he scores with a smile or being happy or anything. I don't know what that is to read into that. Every guy handles those situations on the ice differently. But he's definitely in the rumor mill. I mean, here's the thing. If you are able to get a number one defenseman to play with Rasmus Dahlin, you might have to package him as a part of it. Jason Robertson being, rumored with Dallas that he could be available. Well, if Paterka's part of that deal to get you him, then you got to do it. You have to give up something to get something good. I still think that if I'm Adams, I'm advising him, look, even if you have to overtrade a prospect or overtrade a pick, that's where you do it. Because, again, his job, he might not see next trade deadline. So for him, that's where I would go for it. To me, you need more trades like you did with Edmonton. You trade a draft pick, you trade a highly touted prospect like Matt Savoy, and you trade him to Edmonton, and then you get a guy like Ryan McLeod back. I think there has to be one or two of those this offseason, and maybe one of them is even with a more bigger name than just a third-line player like McLeod.
Brian Koziol, your host of Tee to Green, also the Buffalo Sabres radio network. Tee to Green this week. Brian, tell everybody about it. Where are you guys this week?
We are at Pendleton Creek Golf Club. It's in North Tonawanda, and as we do for majors, we're going 2 hours, so 7 to 9 on WGR, and of course, anywhere on the Odyssey app. So hope you can tune in on Saturday morning, 2 hours. It'll be a ton on the U.S. Open, so we'll be looking forward to talking about it.
Appreciate the time, as always. Brian, enjoy your weekend.
Thanks, guys, and I'll throw in one more note that's interesting. If you're a Phil Mickelson fan, this might be his last crack at the U.S. Open. His eligibility running out here, or in terms of him being able to play after he won the PGA, he got 5 more years. So this is it. His world ranking is way in the hundreds because of him playing on LIV. His last 10 tries at the Open, he hasn't even cracked the top 25, and he's missed the cut at the last three. We know that's still eluding him to get the career Grand Slam. I don't see any scenario that he contends this week, but I figured if you're a Mickelson fan, soak it in. This is probably his last chance to get a U.S. Open.
Brian, great nugget there. Appreciate it. Let's do this again.
Thanks, guys. Talk soon.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Koziol. He is the host of Tee to Green on WGR and the Odyssey app. You can check it out every week. Giving us a little primer there on the U.S. Open round one tomorrow.
Right. That was that the U.S. Open where he hits the tent? Mickelson, yeah. He's leading and just for whatever reason just, implodes at the end.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Yeah.
So that's the one tournament he hasn't gotten.
Is the U.S. Open.
For the career Grand Slam. Great golfer, but boy, hard to imagine him being in contention when you factor what Scheffler has been, what DeChambeau has been. But it'll be fun. It'll be fun to watch. I guess it's fun to watch the golf course fight back against the golfers every now and then. That's what we're expecting this weekend in Pittsburgh. We'll get to Happy Hour next on the Fan Rochester.
Wingfoot 2006.
Wingfoot?
Yeah, he's leading and his tee shot, he uses his driver, hits the hospitality tent. And then
it happens to the best of us. Who amongst us hasn't, right? Happy Hour next. Day two of Buffalo Bills mandatory mini camp. A couple of notes to share from that as well. A round of shots. And don't forget about last call at 866-4FAN. If you want to pull up a stool and join us, 866-4326.
You're listening to The Sports Bar with Danger and Battaglia on 95.7 FM and AM 950, The Fan Rochester.
We know there's a lot that can go on during one night of baseball. Long home runs, epic pitching performances, catches that defy space, time, and gravity.
Climbing the wall, did he catch it? He did!
But what if you could get all of that summarized in a quick, concise, and at least we think, funny podcast that's under 10 minutes? Check out MLB.com's morning lineup. It runs Monday through Friday mornings on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you love listening most.